SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama and welcome to NITV Radio. Bertrand Tungandami ngaya. I am Bertrand Tungandami. Coming up in your program this Wednesday, the 20th of March, 2024, we'll have a conversation with Auntie Vicky Cousins and Alara Briggs Patterson, two of the most anticipated panelists at the Language as a Resistance panel yarn tonight, an event that will delve into the profound intersections of language, Indigenous knowledge systems, and activism in art. In the program, we also look at the incidence of lung and cervical cancer as it is in the spotlight at a global First Nations health conference in NAM. And social media companies issued with legal notices by Australia's online safety regulator to outline their strategies to stop the spread of harmful content online. All these stories and more coming to you after the latest news on NITV Radio.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
This bulletin, there is growing support for an institute aiming to tackle gender equality for First Nations women and girls. Donald Trump lashes out at Australia's ambassador to the US, Kevin Rudd. And the head of UNRWA, the UN Humanitarian Assistance Body for Palestinians, blocked from entering the Gaza Strip. There has been widespread support for a new institute that aims to tackle gender equality for First Nations women and girls. The First Nations Gender Justice Institute, based at the Australian National University, intends to design and scale up Indigenous gender-informed approaches to the issue, as well as contribute to policy development. Former Prime Minister Julia Gillard, who is the current chair of the Global Institute for Women's Leadership, has said the institute will play an important role in looking for effective strategies on gender equality. She has argued there are forces that threaten to set back progress.
We've seen the rise of discord, of popularism. Populist right-wing governments have also used gender very, very clearly to mobilise their base. I mean, we see it happening in places like Hungary, certainly seeing it on reproductive rights in the US, and we will see it manifest in many more election cycles over this year, which is a huge year of elections.
The federal government has pushed back against opposition claims that are making it impossible to reach a bipartisan consensus on religious discrimination laws. Opposition leader Peter Dutton and Tasmanian Liberal MP Bridget Archer have both said they are yet to see the content of two bills that have been drafted on the planned changes. Mr. Dutton has even accused Labor of positioning the opposition as a scapegoat if the legislation is stalled or thwarted. But Attorney General Mark Dreyfus says those fears have no basis.
This is something that Australians have been talking about for a very long time. There have been some 10 inquiries since 2016. It's something that we've been consulting with the community about, with faith leaders about for a very long time, and we are looking forward to working constructively with the opposition. We are aiming to reach a bipartisan outcome.
Donald Trump has attacked former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd in an interview on British network GB News. The interview was conducted with high-profile British Conservative Nigel Farage, who said he wanted to ask about AUKUS and Rudd on behalf of Sky News Australia. Now Australia's ambassador to the United States, Mr. Rudd has previously described Mr. Trump as a destructive president who is a traitor to the West. In a response to Nigel Farage's questions about their potential professional relationship if Mr. Trump were re-elected, the former president has suggested Mr. Rudd's tenure in the position would be brief.
No. Would you take a phone call from him?
He won't be there long if that's the case. I don't know much about him. I heard he was a little bit nasty. I hear he's not the brightest bulb, but I don't know much about him. But if he's at all hostile, he will not be there long.
Victoria has announced plans to conduct an electronic monitoring trial of teenage offenders. Under the plan, selected young people charged with serious offences would be required to wear ankle bracelets to alert police if they're not following their bail conditions, allowing police to apply for that bail to be revoked. Attorney General Jacqueline Symes says the trial would be rolled out alongside more intensive bail supervision to keep young people in education, work and other programs. She says the impending change is designed to cut reoffending rates by a small number of people who are driving an increase in serious youth crimes.
This is about a balanced approach. This is about ensuring that we are focusing our attention on a cohort of young people that we're quite concerned about. There is a therapeutic element to this, and that is what has got many people in the government convinced that this is worth a trial.
The Foreign Affairs Minister has signalled her intention to raise the case of an imprisoned Australian writer during her talks this afternoon with her Chinese counterpart. Dr. Yang Hengjun faces life in prison after his 2-year death sentence was suspended over national security charges the writer and the Australian government have always denied. Some commentators say there is unlikely to be any headway in the case as there was with the detained Australian journalist Cheng Lai, who was released by China last year because of the basis of the writer's charges. But the minister says these are issues the parties agreed to discuss during their last meeting.
You and I also agreed on the importance of dialogue between our two countries, not just to take forward our shared interests, but also to exchange views on the issues that matter to us and to navigate wisely any differences we have.
Beijing has told the United States not to stir up trouble over a dispute that is centered around the South China Sea. There have been regular clashes between Chinese and Filipino forces near a disputed shoal in the South China Sea, which has turned more hostile, including a face-off between the two coast guards on March 5 that injured 5 Filipino personnel. China's foreign ministry spokesperson, Lin Jian, says the U.S. is not a party to the issue, has no right to intervene, and must ensure its military cooperation with the Philippines does not undermine China's sovereignty and maritime rights. The remarks follow a visit by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken to Ferdinand Marcos Jr., where he has told the Filipino president their country's relationships is in hyperdrive.
That's so true. We see it across every domain. It's something that we attach great importance to. We have the same priorities, whether it's economic development, whether it's dealing with climate change, with food security, of course, upholding international law.
The head of the United Nations Humanitarian Agency for Palestinian Refugees has been refused entry to the Gaza Strip. UNRWA Director General Philip Lazzarini says he was singled out as he attempted to enter Rafah to check out the deteriorating conditions there ahead of an Israeli assault.
I hear that COGAT said that it has been denied just because we have not filled the right form, or at least that was a public explanation. But be reassured that all the members of my delegation were authorized to enter.
Mr. Lazzarini alleges that Israel blocked him as retaliation for alleging publicly that he believes Israel's aim is to destroy the agency long at the forefront of relief efforts and education in Gaza. But Defense Ministry body COGAT has maintained he did not follow the necessary coordination processes and channels when requesting entry. COGAT has called the incident another attempt by the agency to blame Israel for their own mistakes. Back home, a body has been found in the debris of a house destroyed by fire in the North Queensland city of Townsville. Police say they believe the person to be a resident of the house. Three other men in their 40s and 50s have been taken to hospital after being treated at the scene for burns and smoke inhalation. It's not known if the three men lived at the Hermit Park house. And to sport, Queensland says it's pushing ahead with plans for the 2032 Summer Olympics in Brisbane amid reports the state government sought advice on cancelling the event. Premier Stephen Miles has denied a Nine News report that it has considered cancelling the games because of venue costs and waning public support. He says the government will be spending $1.6 billion on a Suncorp Stadium upgrade for the opening and closing ceremonies, as well as the Queensland Sport and Athletics Centre for track and field events. And now, having a look at the weather around the country, this Wednesday, Broome, scattered thunderstorms, 33, Perth, sunny, 31, Adelaide, similar conditions, 24, Melbourne, mostly sunny, 21, Hobart, partly cloudy, 21, Albury-Wodonga, mostly cloudy, 21, Canberra, sunny, 20, Wollongong, cloudy, 21, Sydney, similar conditions, 23, Newcastle, cloudy, 24, Brisbane, a shower or 228, Townsville, cloudy and 31, Cairns, much the same, 31, Alice Springs, showers and a top of 26, Darwin, showers and possible storm, 32 degrees and the Torres Strait Islands, light thunderstorms and rain and a top of 31 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
TV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
And that was Mother Tongue by Kucha Edwards, coming to you on NITV Radio. I'm Bertrand Tungandame, and we are broadcasting from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Wednesday afternoon. Coming up next, we look at the incidence of lung and cervical cancer as it has been in the spotlight at a global First Nations health conference in Nam. And social media companies issued with legal notices by Australia's online safety regulator to outline their strategies to stop the spread of harmful content online. But first, this Wednesday, March the 20th, the Footscray Arts Centre will host an event exploring the intersections of language, identity and activism in art. Shortly before the programme, I caught up with two of the most anticipated panellists to give some insights into what will be discussed.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Languages Resistance Panel Yarn, hosted by the Footscray Arts Centre this Wednesday, the 20th of March, will delve into the profound intersections of language, Indigenous knowledge systems and activism in art. Panelists will offer unique insights into the power of language, identity and cultural preservation in the face of historical oppression and contemporary challenges. I'm happy to say I'm joined by two of the panelists at the event. Auntie Vicky Cousins, a Kundish Mara woman who is a leader in cultural revitalization across creative expressions, from language to visual arts. And Alara Briggs Patterson, a Yota Yota artist who weaves healing textures through music addressing themes of black justice and sovereignty. Auntie Vicky and Alara, thanks for joining us and welcome to NITV Radio.
Thank you. Great to be here and to have this opportunity to speak about a passion.
Thanks so much. I'm really happy to be here also.
I'll start with a question to Vicky. You work across various creative mediums for cultural revitalization. Can you elaborate on how artistic expression plays a vital role in language reclamation and revival efforts?
Well, I do use the term creative cultural expression because those, we don't really identify the art as a separate kind of practice or way of expression. I think we have the contemporary expressions as well as the more what some might be termed traditional expressions through ceremony and song and body paint up and those kinds of things that are part of ceremonies. And language is central and absolutely integral and inherent in those practices, both the customary practices and contemporary practices, as we're seeing with Alara and other people in performance. Myself, I use, when I'm using visual arts, I'll use language as text or absolutely as titles and part of the explanations in my work. It is an action of resistance to assert those things, like your mother tongue, your language, which is, you know, a birthright. So I think they're really important. And in these times now, we are in a time from the work of our old people and all those elders who've gone before us that we have the freedom in some respects to pursue those things and reinvigorate and bring those practices, especially language, back into our lived daily lives as well as our creative cultural expression and cultural practices. It's really important. That doesn't even convey the absolute necessity for the revitalization. And of course, Lou's word, who coined the phrase rematriation, which I know Alara is going to talk a bit about. I can't even find the words in English to express the importance and necessity of reinvigorating our languages.
Yeah. And Lara, just tell us, as a storyteller, how do you incorporate traditional narratives and cultural practices into your art forms?
Thank you for asking, and I definitely can relate to Anivikki there. Like, words can't express what it means for the importance of us to be speaking our languages and practicing the different ways that we can continue our cultural, culture, life. Life itself. So it's not even this one thing that's separate from our everyday life. I mean, we coin it as this term, culture, as if it's separate from our life because we live in such a heavily saturated Western society that culture becomes this different thing, but it's our life. It's what we live and breathe. It's how we continue our stories and talk about our ancestors and our elders, and it's how we share our hopes and dreams for the future. And you know, you do that in so many different forms. I do it in music and song. And so for me, with language, as you said, it's our birthright to know our languages. I guess I'm trying to create, I guess, something that I wish I had as a kid, that I wish I was born into. I was born into English, and that's something that Maya Ntiki as well is going to talk a lot about today, this evening.
Yeah.
Is that her kind of refusal to speak English as a, you know, a second colonial language on top of Japanese, when, you know, it was her birthright to have Ainu as her first language, and as it was for us to have our languages as our first language. So I'm trying to think of the right words, but there is no right words because they're all in English. These ones that we're choosing to say, I use language here or I speak language here. It's about connection to ourself and our country and our old ones and, you know, every other living, breathing person and non-person beings that connect us all.
And Auntie Vicky, how do you see the revitalization of cultural knowledge and practice contributing to healing in Aboriginal individuals, families and communities?
I think it's absolutely integral, and it is, like Alara is saying, the use of culture, like in some ways English creates that separateness, but it's how we live and it's who we are, and it's like any other culture, it's your lived experience of how you go about your daily life. How can I say it? Like, we're on the oldest continent on the planet, with the oldest living cultures, with the oldest languages.
Yeah.
And we have the fastest attrition rates. And I don't like to say language is lost, because language is of the land and we are of the land, and language is body. So you can't lose it, but you do have to relearn it. And the reactivation of many of our practices, like I said before, the colonial regime continues.
Yeah.
And therefore the perpetration of genocide and linguicide is a continuing thing, and it's not always as obvious as dodging bullets. You know, we still have the terrible rates of deaths in custody and children in out-of-home care and all those things that we hear, all the negative stories. We are still in the colonial regime, and the system is not set up for our success or to support us. And I'm in several roles where I'm able to represent and advocate and push, go hard. I'm not just nicely advocating. Go hard in those spaces to find the resourcing and support, because the value of our culture and languages is just not there.
Yeah.
In whilst we're having the truth telling and we're having the conversations in the wider community, and many of our things that our old people have been fighting for and we have are on the national and state agendas, the process is still dictated by the Western systems that we work under. So for our communities, it's absolutely vital. And we've been addressing those issues of housing, employment, education, a feed on the table and a roof over your head, essential survival things.
Yeah.
And now we are in places where we're starting to be able to really assert the necessities of having our languages and those things reinstated. It's a human right, and Victoria has a human rights charter, which they're in breach of. So are the federal government. And the federal government finally signed up members to the United Nations Declaration on the Indigenous Rights of Indigenous People, UNDRIP.
Yeah.
And they're still failing spectacularly, in my opinion, to address any or many of those rights.
Yeah.
With respect and with genuine will and intent.
Yeah, they just sign a piece of paper, but when it comes to walking the walk, then they're not there. They don't respond to...
Yeah, well, this whole big closing the gap thing and the Productivity Commission report actually finally kind of points that out to them.
Yeah. And you, Alara, your work addresses themes of healing through music. Can you describe how you create these textures and how music acts as a healing tool in your artistic expression?
Yeah, definitely. Adding on to what Auntie Vicky is saying here is there's just so much that we have to face every day just to survive. And there's just so much horrificness and atrocities being perpetrated against our mob still. So for brief moments of reprieve, I play double bass and I create a world that is, vibrations and it's music. And I hope that other people can receive that as well, because it feels like a gift for me to get to play. It's not the easiest thing for somebody to have a double bass or, have a musical instrument But we do have our voices. And so, yeah, my hope is that for our people, we can, yeah, we can work more to understand our stories, all of the detail and the depth that country holds and that our stories and our beliefs hold, to, yeah, work on our, you know, whatever we want to call them. And it's never going to be the right word because this one's in English, but song lines, song cycles, and understanding the way that we move through and walk through the places that connect us back to who we are and back to creation of the lands that we live within. I think there is so much depth of understanding and knowledge and lore within those stories that once we have more accessibility to be able to sing and share those stories, that will bring healing to us as a people, us as a so-called Australian nation, because it's very, 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 very important. It's at the core of what has made us and these lands, yeah, so-called Australia, and for me in particular, Yorta Yorta Winya, it's made us who we are, and we're not separate. Again, like, we're not separate from that. We've come from that, and where we're going is environmental collapse and people dying left, right, and centre in the most horrific ways all across the globe. There's Indigenous people all over the world who are, you know, wanting and just like yearning for the same things, to be able to speak our languages, to tell our stories.
And that was Yorta Yorta woman, Lara Briggs Patterson, ending this three-way conversation ahead of her participation in the Languages Resistance Panuyan at the Footscray Art Centre later tonight. And this is just part of the conversation, which I recorded earlier this morning, leading up to the event this evening. You can find the full conversation on our website, sbs.com.au/NITV Radio. We must now step aside for a break, but stay with us, because when we come back, we'll look at the impact of colonization on health and the prevalence of cancer within the Indigenous community.
NITV Radio, on radio, online and mobile.
And that was Don't You Worry by Electric Fields, coming to you on NITV Radio this Wednesday afternoon as we broadcast from Nam on the Kulin Nation. Now, lung and cervical cancer are in the spotlight at a Global First Nations Health Conference in Nam. The World Indigenous Cancer Conference aims to foster better working relationships and collaboration between experts from across the globe. Sydney Lung reports.
Opening with song and dance. The beginning of this year's World Indigenous Cancer Conference is being marked by a respect and appreciation of culture. First Nations health experts and cancer researchers from around the world have gathered in Nam, Melbourne, to collaborate and shine a light on one of the leading causes of death for Indigenous Australians. This year, the conference is placing particular focus on lung and cervical cancer, the former of which remains the biggest killer of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. Yarrawoo woman and Associate Professor Kalinda Griffiths is the national convener of the conference and explains one of the reasons lung cancer is more prevalent in Indigenous Australians.
If we are going to get lung cancer, it's probably going to affect us about 20 years down the track. Because we have a reduced, I guess, intake, also people aren't having the reduction around smoking uptake over time, what we're seeing is an ongoing and increasing lung cancer rate. Basically, it's a 20-year lag time. We've got Aboriginal people who have taken up smoking at a later date and they're not putting it down as quickly as non-Indigenous people. That's basically the premise of this.
Data from the Australian Institute of Health shows that even as numbers are declining, Indigenous people are still nearly three times as likely to pick up smoking. Kamilaroi woman and Professor of Indigenous Health Research at the University of Queensland, Gail Garvey, says Australia's health system is not designed to benefit Indigenous people.
We don't have Indigenous people working in cancer care and supporting our Indigenous populations. We're also dealing with health systems and cancer care services that are outright racist, and they don't support our Indigenous populations with their language. They don't communicate in a way that Indigenous populations can understand what their diagnosis is, what treatment is available.
Also in the spotlight is cervical cancer. While decreasing in prevalence for non-Indigenous populations due to the HPV vaccine, the cancer is still an issue for Indigenous populations, both in Australia and around the world. Professor Garvey says a key reason for this is the lack of appropriate cancer prevention and awareness strategies for Indigenous peoples.
The World Health Organization has a strategy to eliminate cervical cancer around the world. If we're going to do that, we have to ensure that we include Indigenous populations. Australia is saying they're going to be one of the first countries in the world to eliminate cervical cancer. Well, that may be the case for non-Indigenous Australians, but if we're going to do that for Indigenous Australians, we need to put the focus, we need to put the people, we need to put the voices of Indigenous people at the centre of these discussions if we're going to make a difference.
CEO of the Victorian Comprehensive Cancer Centre Alliance, Professor Grant MacArthur, says the conference will also look into the prevalence of liver cancer.
At the Victorian Comprehensive Cancer Centre Alliance, we have recognised that liver cancer is a cancer with the greatest gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians, and we see the same thing in North America. So we have a program to take the very latest in discovery of the science of liver cancer with a strong focus on what we can do to turn that around, given that huge gap for First Nations people in Australia and across the world.
Professor Garvey says the conference is an opportunity to learn and collaborate with Indigenous researchers worldwide.
To come and share what they're doing in their country so we can learn from that and we can share what's working and what's not working, and we can come together as Indigenous peoples with a focus on trying to improve outcomes for Indigenous populations. We can do this together. And so it's a strong collaboration of people from Canada, the United States, Aotearoa, New Zealand, and the many other Indigenous nations around the world.
Cultural safety is another key priority for the conference, with yarning circles and spaces to hear and share stories for both elders and young people, fostering intergenerational discussions about health and community. Professor Griffiths says it's key to understand what so many Indigenous populations have in common and the clear impact it has on health.
We've been colonised. At the end of the day, colonisation is bad for our health, and there's a lack of trust in what governments and also what non-Indigenous people are saying. So we really do need to drive some of those discussions from the leadership within the cancer sector, but also from the health prevention sector as well.
Sydney Lang, SBS News.
Visit sbs.com.au/NITV Radio.
We must now step aside for a break, but stay with us, because when we come back, we look at calls on social media companies to outline their strategies to stop the spread of harmful content online or face tens of millions of dollars in fines. Welcome back. Now, six social media companies have been issued with legal notices by Australia's online safety regulator to outline their strategies to stop the spread of harmful content by terrorists and violent extremists. Meta, Google, X, Telegram, WhatsApp and Reddit have 49 days to explain their steps that they'll be taking to protect Australians or face tens of millions of dollars in fines. Biwa Kwan reports.
The spread of extremist content online and its impact on Australians is a growing problem that Australia's independent regulator for online safety is determined to stop. Julian McGrant is the eSafety Commissioner.
Unfortunately, it is a growing problem, and what we're seeing is so many of these platforms are enabling themselves to be weaponized by violent extremists. Because, you know, attention and conflict sells, and the business model is to keep things sticky and for the algorithms to continue serving up more and more conflict to keep people engaged. Now, depending on how harmful the content is, that can obviously have harmful impacts on individuals and, by extension, society.
The Safety Commission has recorded more reports of the recirculation of harmful content on social media platforms, including the 2019 terrorist attack in Christchurch. It also continues to receive reports of online hate incidents. Those from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds experience online hate speech at higher levels than the national average in Australia. Ms. Emma Grant says when it comes to online harm, the time for self-regulation is over. Using powers under the Online Safety Act, the regulator has issued legal notices to six social media companies: Google, Meta, X formerly known as Twitter, WhatsApp, Telegram, and Reddit.
We need to know that they're investing and they're innovating in their trust and safety infrastructure, that they're putting protections in at the front end to prevent their platforms from being weaponized, from terrorist and violent extremist content being hosted, shared, and then amplified.
They have 49 days to comply with the legal notice or face the prospect of tens of millions of dollars in penalties. Earlier this month, the UN-backed Tech Against Terrorism group said it had identified users of an IS forum talking about ways of using generative AI to further spread their message. Ms. Inman Grant says transparency and accountability are the keys to tackling online harm.
Radicalization can happen very slowly and very subtly, or it can cause intense fear happen very quickly. But we are really concerned about the really extreme content, the beheadings, the kidnappings, the really violent shootings, that are imagery that our young people are seeing that they cannot unsee, so very harmful. But it's the corrosive impact that some of this imagery, some of this ideology has over time that can really tear at the social fabric of democracy and social cohesion.
A recent OECD report ranked the social media platforms with the highest prevalence of terrorist and violent extremist material. Telegram was first on the list, followed by YouTube and then the platform X. The Meta-owned Facebook and Instagram were ranked fourth and fifth, respectively. Professor of Global Islamic Politics at Deakin University, Greg Barton, studies ways of countering violent extremism and terrorism. He says generative AI has only accelerated the challenges of responding to online harm.
One of the real challenges is we're going to see content produced that we won't know whether it's real or it's not real. And part of the danger there is we stop trusting anything and anyone, that we just lose our sense of confidence in what's real. We've already seen this with shades of fake news and anti-science conspiracy theory during the COVID-19 pandemic. That was exacerbated by social media. Generative AI is going to have the capacity to pump out a much larger volume of more convincing material, whether it's text or whether it's images and video, and that's going to make the current challenges we face seem relatively trivial compared with what's coming.
Professor Barton says the presence of extremist and terrorism material online makes it harder for people to engage in online spaces that are safe. It also creates more division and can become a breeding ground for radicalisation. He says extremists and terrorists exploit human vulnerabilities, and countering it requires building more positive community connections.
The thing to understand is that this is driven largely by social and psychological needs. So where there's a vulnerability, where there's an absence, where somebody needs something, then they're at risk of somebody stepping in who doesn't have their best interest at heart offering to provide that. It's tempting to think that we can solve this by arguing with them if they have ideas which strike us as extreme, by just sort of trying to rebut the ideas. That's not the best place to start or even proceed with. The main thing is to keep connection, keep the channels of communication open. Try as best we can to say that we're not being judgmental. We just care about you. We want to talk. Tell me about what's happening. And if you can keep those connections open, hopefully that can be a balancing force against other voices they're hearing. And in time, if they become disillusioned with those other voices, which typically is the case, it's easy for them to come back to family and friends and community. If we close them out and they've got nowhere to go, they're much more vulnerable and it's harder for them to come back.
The country's terrorism threat level remains at possible. But in the last 18 months, Australia's National Security Agency, ASIO, has recorded an increase in activity by extremists spreading violence and hate. Delivering the latest annual threat assessment last month, ASIO's Director General of Security, Mike Burgess, says the agency is monitoring the issue closely. Ms. Immigrant says everyone has a role to play in responding to the rise in online hate. She says tackling it is a global challenge, and more agencies internationally are working together to find solutions.
Well, the eSafety Commissioner was the first online safety regulator set up in the world in 2015, and for the first 7 years, we were largely the only one writing the playbook as we went along, and that, thankfully, is changing. We just had the Home Affairs Commissioner from the European Commission in the office yesterday talking to us about their terrorism legislation, where they have 100% compliance rate, so working together with the European Union, where they're a very powerful regional bloc with a lot of expertise in regulating, is going to make us stronger. I mean, we may go faster on our own, but we'll go further together.
Biwa Kwan, SBS News.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
And that's all we have for you this Wednesday afternoon. NITV Radio will be back on Friday with more news and stories from right across the country. But I also invite you to check our website, sbs.com.au/NITV Radio. We constantly update this website with new content, some of which never goes to air. It's online only. I am Bertrand Tungandame, thanking you for your company this Wednesday afternoon. Till next time, bye for now. Yalu.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.